Since the spring, we've occasionally heard from freelancer Caitlin Shetterly. In April, money troubles led her and her husband Dan Davis to leave Los Angeles with their three-month-old baby to move in with Caitlin's mother in Maine. Dan is a freelance photographer, but he hadn't had a job since December. With the new baby, Caitlin had been counting on Dan to help support them. They lived with Caitlin's mother for 5 months, and then in September, Dan decided to go back to school. Here Caitlin continues her family's story.
Your class goes from
2 to 5.
At the end of August, Dan and I moved into our own apartment in Portland, Maine. 2 weeks later, we dove headfirst into what felt like our only lifeline. A master's for Dan, which we hoped would bring more opportunities if and when the recession lifted. 3 days a week, he took the bus 2 hours south to Boston with a packed lunch of peanut butter sandwiches, homemade hummus, pretzels, and apples.
You think that you're going to be pretty sick of hummus in a little while?
3 nights a week, Dan drove a half an hour each way to a bartending job. I was alone with our 9-month-old son and trying during nap times and at night to do a small amount of freelance work and also work on a book proposal inspired by my blog and NPR diaries. We were barely scraping by. One morning as Dan, our son, and I ate breakfast, I told him that caring for a baby and the household alone and also trying to make money on top of that was starting to feel impossible for me. For Dan, it was hard to come home every night.
I'll have a good day in classes, and I feel like this is the right thing. I feel challenged by professors, by other students, and I feel like, all right, we're moving. This is going to be a good experience, and it's going to put us in a better place. And then I come home, and you've had a bad day, or you're overwhelmed, and then it goes from being something that feels positive to feeling like a nuisance and troublesome.
3 weeks in, Dan and I were talking about what it would look like if he dropped out of school. But first, we tried to trim every bit of fat from our budget. We lowered our cell phone plans, got a landline with no features, started hanging our laundry to dry, and began ordering food from a bulk buyer's club.
Chickpeas, organic, 25 pounds, they're $1.09 a pound.
Yeah, it's 70 cents cheaper.
Okay, so let's get those.
Still, the stress was mounting. With Dan's travel costs and the unpredictability of his bartending tips, the numbers were not working out. Creditors from our year of financial collapse were dogging our answering machine.
Wednesday, 3:04 p.m. Friday, 9:50.
We hit a breaking point when Dan decided to call my dad to ask for help.
It was a hard conversation because I had to admit to your father that I made a mistake when I already felt like I've made a mistake, several mistakes that got us into this situation. And yeah, the end result was I had to ask him for money and for him to help us.
I understood that as a man and a father, Dan couldn't help but blame himself for everything that had happened to us since the recession began. My dad came through with the margin we were short. Even so,
Saturday,
our debt loomed.
10:56 a.m.
Suddenly, a light appeared in the darkness. The book proposal I'd written about our journey west and back home again started to get interest from publishers. My agent set up phone meetings, and then, overnight, there were offers on the table. We sold the book. That day, we had $16 in our bank account and an empty fridge. Like that, our lives changed.
Great, well, I just signed away our lives. I just signed my contract. Excited.
That's great. How do you feel?
When I called my mom to tell her we might not have to move back in with her just yet, she said that we needed to remember that luck was not the primary ingredient in this sudden, exciting success.
You know, I really do believe that you and Dan have worked very hard, and that counts for something. So when opportunity comes along, that you have a preparation for it. That's what I think. But yeah, I mean, it's a Cinderella story.
A little bit, yeah. A little bit.
My book deal is not enough money to retire on or even buy a house. But to us, it's huge because it gives us a chance to bail out. No sooner do we adjust to our good fortune, however, than we start eyeing the ominous pile of bills in the corner.
I mean, here's what we have today. We have our credit card bills. So we have our hospital bill for what the insurance didn't cover. We have to pay back your dad.
Well, we're not going to be able to pay everything at once.
As we pay back and equalize our lives, Dan and I know that what we're learning from our journey through the recession is to simplify. Last weekend, we were back home at my mother's, where we lived for 5 months this year. We celebrated Thanksgiving, made kindling, and got her house ready for winter. This holiday season, we're celebrating the time we've spent together as a family and would never have been lucky enough to have shared if the recession had not rocked our world and made us come home.
You can go to our website, npr.org, for a link to Caitlin Shetterly's blog about her family's journey through the recession, along with her husband Dan's photos documenting their story. Caitlin Shetterly's story for NPR have been edited by Andrea De Leon and produced by Rolando Arrieta. Climate change can be a hard sell. World leaders have tried for years to come up with an agreement on the issue. They'll try again when they meet in Copenhagen next week. It's hard to sell climate change to the general public, too, despite any number of ads and awareness campaigns launched by the government, advocacy groups, and corporations that have turned green into a superlative. The number of Americans who believe climate change is a serious problem has been in decline, according to a recent study by Pew Research. Ed Maybach, director of the Center for Climate Change Communications at George Mason University, joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Why do you think the issue is becoming apparently less important to people over the past few years?
I think there's two big things going on. Number one is the economy. It's been in a shambles for quite some time now, and psychologists tell us that there's such a thing as a limited pool of worry, a finite pool of worry. We can only worry about so many things at any one time, and most people that I know are fairly worried about the economy, so it tends to have the effect of forcing their concern about other issues further from top of mind. The second thing that's absolutely going on right now is this is a highly contested issue. There's a battle raging in Congress right now about passing climate legislation, and lots of people, lots of organizations are vying for the hearts and minds of the public to influence them in one direction or the other.
At the same time, if you were to follow advertisements, you certainly get the impression that major corporations have decided that, I believe we said, green is a superlative. If you want to sell something, you have to tell people it's green.
They absolutely are, sometimes legitimately. In other words, they're trying to develop greener, cleaner products and services, sometimes not so legitimately. In other words, trying to reassure us that everything's okay. They're on the job. Their heat-trapping pollution emissions are something that are well within their control and decreasing all the time.
Help explain then why there might be at least statistically a disconnect between a general public that seems to want greener consumer products and a general public that says, I'm not as worried about global warming as I used to be, or at least it's not as big a concern as it used to be in my priority of worries.
People do make decisions as consumers, and they make decisions as citizens. And with regard to their decisions as consumers, we do see an increasing proportion of Americans trying to change the way they shop to be a more environmentally conscious citizen. Conversely, with regard to how people act as citizens, even those Americans who care most about global warming, they tend not to actually stand up and be counted with their elected officials.
You've heard about this recent email controversy.
I have.
Now, we'll explain. Someone hacked into the, or more than someone, hacked into the computers of the venerable Hadley Research Center, University of East Anglia, climate research unit in England, and revealed quite a few emails that seemed to show that its leading climatologists seemed to have ignored, dismissed, concealed, sometimes even destroyed some raw data that didn't seem to support their conclusions. This has been fodder for skeptics of global warming. What do you make of it?
Well, it certainly wasn't helpful. The timing is particularly bad in the sense that the leaders of the world are gathering next week in Copenhagen. To the best of my knowledge, it doesn't actually show any misdeeds, but it certainly does show a whole lot of rhetoric, inflammatory rhetoric often, flying back and forth between colleagues. So I think at very least it was unhelpful.
Ed Maybach, Director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Edith Piaf is usually thought of as a gifted, tragic figure, a great voice and spirit who sang through lost loves, loneliness, drink, and depression. Padam, 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 il me fait le coup du souviens-toi. Padam, padam, padam. But actress and singer Gay Marshall takes a different approach to Piaf. Il dit rappelle-toi tes amours, rappelle-toi puisque c'est ton tour. She sees a joyful, mischievous side to France's Little Sparrow. Gay Marshall is a Piaf scholar and performer. She just finished a run of her one-woman Piaf show. Her new CD is titled Gay Marshall Sings Piaf, La Vie, L'Amour. Gay Marshall joins us from her studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott. So how, very happy to be here.
How does a kid from Cleveland wind up being a Piaf devotee?
Well, it was totally by chance. I read a book about her, and I suddenly had to sing those songs. I had no choice.
Now, you felt so deeply about this, as I believe I've read the story, you were appearing in Cats and took a vacation to go to France to find out about Piaf.
I was doing Chorus Line, actually.
Chorus Line. You had the big number in Chorus Line,
yes,
didn't you? What I did for love. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I won a contest that was judged by Leona Helmsley, of all people, and they sent me to Paris. And what I did was travel the city by following the places that she had lived and sung.
Let's hear a little bit of your different interpretation. We're going to take what is arguably the best-known Piaf song, certainly one of the best-known songs in the world, La Vie en Rose, and hear your interpretation. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Fair to call that playful?
She actually wrote the words to that song, which a lot of people don't know. They think that she was just an interpreter of songs, but she wrote quite a few.
So what do the depictions of Piaf we've grown used to, and I'm, of course, most recently there's the 2007 film, La Vie en Rose. What are some of those depictions? I don't want to say, in your judgment, they're wrong, but what do they miss in Piaf?
I think that they lay too heavily on the same old, tragic, sort of sensationalist part of her life, which definitely existed. I mean, she did have a drug problem, but they always neglect to mention that her drug addiction came from being put on morphine from doctors who prescribed it, because she was in a series of car accidents in the 50s that almost killed her, every single one of them. And she wouldn't wait until she'd recuperated to get back on stage. It was sort of a catch-22. She had to sing to live, and she lived to sing.
She really did have, Yeah, I think it's fair to say a tragic love life and the death of her lover.
Yes. Now, that it seems as though her life was going great guns until the death of Marcel Cerdan. And I don't think she ever got over...
We should explain the French heavyweight, fine heavyweight boxer and great national symbol in France.
Yes. He won the 1947 championship, I think, here at Madison Square Garden. And... But she had asked him to come to the United States, and he was already booked on the boat. And she said, oh, take the plane, take the plane. And the plane crashed, for all of you who don't know the story. And then I don't think she really ever got over that. But nothing ever sort of beat her down. She always rose to the occasion. She wrote songs for him. She sang to him. And it became another motivation for her art. She was so amazingly resilient and courageous. I think that there's more to be celebrated about her than just her voice. It's where her voice comes from. She was literally born on the street and rose to be the greatest singer that France has ever produced to this day.
You have performed Piaf in France.
Yes, I have. It's a tricky proposition.
Oh, boy, yes.
I mean,
exact analogies are imperfect, of course, but it would be a little bit like a French actor coming over here and trying to play Mickey Mantle.
Or
a French singer trying
Judy
to...
Garland?
Judy Garland is what was in my mind, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if someone went somewhere over the rainbow, you know, I don't think anybody would really be into it. And so I worked very, very, very hard on my accent. And it was, you know, one person said to me when he asked me what I did, and I said I sang Piaf. He said, "You can't do that. You're not French." And it really upset him that I had sort of taken a chunk out of his heritage in some way. So I stopped saying that I sing Piaf, because what would happen is people say, "What do you do?" I say, I sing Piaf. And there would be a little pause. This is French people. And then they'd smile and go, "Formidable." Really, sort of, how nice for you. I don't ever say no.
I don't think wrong or right. I don't think I just go. Perhaps the most controversial thing from the French point of view you've done is to take some signature Piaf songs and sung them in English.
Yes. But I'm very happy to say that lucky me, one of the authors that I met, gave me his blessing. And then that gave me the courage to go and find the other ones. And everyone, except Georges Moustaki, gave me their blessing on the translations, because Georges Moustaki was quitting smoking that day. And he was in a very bad mood. La belle histoire d'amour.
I will take some license being a Frenchman by marriage to my wife.
Yes, I know.
I can't believe I'm asking this, a kid from Chicago, but can the English language quite convey the way the French lyrics do?
Yes and no. Can I answer like that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Because
we have a lot of politicians on this show.
Because I think the best way to hear them, if you don't speak French, is like the track on my CD, La Belle Histoire d'Amour, The Beautiful Story of Love, goes from French into English and then back into French and then back into English, because then you get the sense of it, but you don't lose the French atmosphere. I will never forget. I was never so sure of my heart of a love. And then on a cold heart, can you do the same thing? No. And I don't think you can make Sophisticated Lady into French.
Ms. Marshall, thanks very much.
Oh, it was wonderful. Thank you.
Gay Marshall. Her new CD is Gay Marshall Sings Piaf, La Vie Le Mort. She joins us from our studios in New York. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, nous éloigne l'un de l'autre, je lutte et je me débat. Mais le son de ma voix s'étouffe dans le rire des autres, et je crie de douleur, de fureur et de rage, et je pleure. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Sahn. Je suis emporté au loin. Et je crispe mes poings, maudissant la foule qui me folle, comme qu'elle m'avait donné, que je n'ai jamais retrouvé. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Been some time since there was anything positive to say about the job market, but a report released yesterday by the Labor Department contained the clearest evidence yet that the unemployment picture may finally be improving. The government said the unemployment rate not only did not go up, it actually fell a bit in November to 10%. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The government said businesses cut 11,000 jobs from their payrolls last month. The losses were a tenth of what economists had been expecting, and they paled beside the massive job hemorrhaging that took place last winter. The government also said job losses in September and October were lower than first thought. Speaking in Pennsylvania, President Obama called the report the best we've seen since 2007.
And this is good news, just in time for the season of hope. I've got to admit, my chief economist, Christy Romer, she got about four hugs when she handed us the report.
It wasn't just that job losses were so low. The report also said temporary help agencies added 52,000 jobs during the month, the fourth straight increase. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
It tends to be the case these days that employers take people on as temporary workers before they actually get permanent employees. So if this isn't an aberration, that's a very good sign.
Then to the length of the average work week also rose, which economists say is often a good sign as well. Nigel Gault of IHS Global Insight says employers have been cutting back jobs for a long time.
And they've probably reached the point where they can't actually extract any more out of their existing workforce. So they need to add hours, and in some cases they need to add staff if they're to continue to increase output.
Once businesses do start hiring, they will have lots of applicants. At a New York State job center in White Plains this week, more than 700 people showed up looking for work. They included Candy Izzello, who lost her job in radio sales just 2 months ago. She's relatively optimistic.
I'm hearing that, you know, some companies are thinking about hiring again for the beginning of the year. I've been on a few different job interviews that said, yes, they are interviewing now for 2010. So it's a good sign. I have hope.
But a lot of the people here have been out of work for many months. Henry Font is a freelance designer of electrical systems. With the collapse in construction, he's had to sell his apartment to survive.
For me, that's the total slowdown. You know, it's like crashing. There is no work. I've been unemployed practically since January. And it's going to be a year.
The government says 14 million people are unemployed, and half of those have lost their jobs since September 2007, when the recession began. Dean Baker says it will take a long time for the labor market to recover, yesterday's jobs report notwithstanding.
And even if we take the best possible reading of this, we could say, okay, maybe we're on the right track, but we have so far to go. That we're looking at a situation, you know, even, say, 3 years out, where suppose we had 6% unemployment, we would ordinarily consider that a horrible story.
And President Obama said something similar yesterday. As encouraging as the jobs report was, he said the unemployment problem is still dire, and Congress needs to pass legislation to create jobs. The president said he'll unveil some ideas to jumpstart private sector hiring next Tuesday. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The debate continues over just how to address the world's environmental problems. Now, earlier this fall, we spoke with Steve Levitt, co-author of Super Freakonomics, and that book proposed some provocative solutions, including figuring out how to pump sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere to help cool down the Earth. The Union of Concerned Scientists wanted to discuss the global cooling described in Super Freakonomics. So we're joined now from studios of WBUR in Boston by Peter Frumhoff, Director of Science and Policy for the UPS. Professor Frumhoff, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Scott.
And from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago, the author, co-author of Super Freakonomics, Steve Levitt, is back with us. Professor Levitt, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Scott.
And before we join the discussion, please, Steve Levitt, remind us of the kind of global warming solutions presented in the book that some people have questioned.
In our book, we start from the premise that the current climate science conclusions are correct and the Earth is getting warmer and we need to do something about it. And from that point, we ask the question, what is the cheapest and most effective way to cool the Earth quickly if we had to? And working with leading scientists, we come to the conclusion that geoengineering approaches, such as directing sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere or creating whitening clouds over the oceans, are a cheaper, a quicker, and a good short-term approach that will be more effective than carbon mitigation in the short run, although, of course, carbon mitigation in the long run is probably still an admirable goal.
Peter Fromhoff?
Well, proposing a geoengineering solution, for example, by increasing sulfate aerosols in the stratosphere mimicking the actions of volcanoes, is basically substituting one big experiment with the Earth that we're driving, that is our carbon pollution, with another, sending large quantities of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere. Most scientists who look carefully at this highlight that there are significant risks that Mr. Levitt and his co-author, Mr. Dubner, didn't mention in their book, making this neither a cheap nor easy nor simple solution to climate change.
Well, but Stephen, let me get you to pick up on that. Wouldn't there be some risk in loading the atmosphere with sulfur dioxide?
Of course there's risk, but the path we're on has risk as well. I mean, I think the idea that a bunch of leaders of nations are going to get together in Copenhagen and come up with a real solution to reducing carbon dioxide emissions that's meaningful and will have an effect in the short run is I think, an unreasonable conclusion. Even if we were to radically cut the amount of carbon dioxide we're emitting, we still would expect the Earth to warm for another 50 to 100 years because of the long half-life of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So the most attractive feature of this approach is that, number one, it's very cheap. Carbon mitigation, I mean, by contrast, is extremely expensive. The estimates are we'd have to spend 1 to 2% of GDP per year for the next 50 years to deal with the problem. What I think the beauty of these geoengineering solutions are, number one, you can do them immediately. They will have immediate effects on the temperature, whereas carbon mitigation will not. Number two, they're completely reversible. If we don't like what happens, we stop putting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and we will undo everything. We will see no trace of it within a year or two. And number three, what it really does is it buys us time. Technology, there's almost, I would say, almost certain that we will be much more effective in taking carbon dioxide out of the air 50 years from now than we are now. So we want to buy time.
Go ahead, Peter.
So if I may, the illusion that it's cheap and easy is frankly nonsense. Increasing stratospheric layers of sulfur dioxide doesn't address the problem that carbon dioxide is causing by increasing the acidity of the oceans as carbon gets absorbed in the oceans. And it's frankly not reversible. If we need to do it, we put it in the atmosphere. We have to do it every year at increasing levels to offset the growing concentrations of carbon dioxide we wouldn't have reduced otherwise. And if we needed to stop doing it, we'd all of a sudden have the large leap of increased heating associated with the carbon dioxide they wouldn't have otherwise reduced.
These geoengineering solutions can be a stopgap, an insurance policy for the globe if things turn very ugly. I think it's very hard to justify an argument against that kind of investment.
The challenge is that your book actually leads the casual reader to believe that it's a substitute for rather than a potential backstop for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And we're actually seeding the U.S. and China and other nations in advance of Copenhagen, putting real emissions reductions targets on the table for meaningful political dialogue. That's important. It's critical to see that move forward. To have, though, geoengineering be the solution, it's a little bit like designing a healthcare system based on the emergency room. You may need it, but you don't want to go there as your first resort.
And if the U.S. were to meet the standards that Barack Obama has proposed, what will happen to the temperature of the Earth over the next 50 years?
Well, we're going to see some warming. There's no doubt. In fact, all scientists recognize that we need to find a way to adapt to the warming that's already locked in. But we can constrain the worst impacts of global warming by reducing our emissions dramatically today. That's what the scientists are calling for. And indeed, if we don't do it, even if you went to a geoengineering approach such as you suggest, the other collateral impacts of carbon dioxide increase that we really can't avoid addressing if we're really to protect the planet for our kids and grandkids.
You simply cannot ignore the fact that spending 1 to 2% of GDP on reducing carbon emissions will have an enormous, enormous negative impact on future economies. The costs are enormous. The risks of doing nothing are also enormous. We need to think not just as climate scientists, not just environmentalists, but as economists when we face this important issue.
Steve Levitt, University of Chicago economist and author of the new book, Super Freakonomics, and Peter Fromhoff, Director of Science and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Dr. Ann Dunham Sutoro didn't live long enough to see her famous son forge his place in American history. President Barack Obama's mother died in 1995 at the age of 52 after a battle with ovarian cancer. In the updated version of his memoir, Dreams from My Father, the president spoke movingly about the last decade of her life.
She had spent the previous 10 years doing what she loved. She traveled the world, working in the distant villages of Asia and Africa, helping women buy a sewing machine or a milk cow or an education that might give them a foothold in the world's economy. She wrote reports, read novels, pestered her children, and dreamed of grandchildren.
That's President Obama reading from his memoir, Dreams from My Father. His mother, Ann Dunham, was an anthropologist. Her fieldwork focused on the small craftsman in a village in Indonesia. Now, nearly two decades after she submitted her dissertation, Ann Dunham's fieldwork has been published, a fulfillment of her dream. The book is called Surviving Against the Odds, and Ann Dunham's daughter and President Obama's sister, Maya Sutoro Ng, was the engine behind its publication, and Maya Sutoro Ng joins me in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your mom's research centered around one small village, Kajar, on the island of Java in Indonesia. Describe what she was trying to find out.
Well, Mom actually started out by looking at a number of different cottage industries. Her hypothesis was that in a time when people were looking at primarily wet rice cultivation, when thinking about the economic development and stability of Indonesia, that there were a lot of cottage industries that were actually indispensable. So she started off by looking at batik and tile making and weaving, and ultimately she decided to go with blacksmithing. And the village of Kajar is a blacksmithing village. It interested her, I think, because there were both utilitarian implements being forged there, but also the Indonesian sacred dagger, the keris, which very often has a serpentine blade and has a rich cultural history and a significant place in the Javanese cosmos.
Your mom was a classic field anthropologist. And I gather, I mean, you were a child through much of the time when she was doing this research in Indonesia. I gather at times you went into the field with her. Do you remember any sort of specific encounters?
I remember many specific encounters. I remember a lot of meals shared. I remember the ritual of taking tea. I remember time spent walking to the rivers. There is a part of her dissertation when she talks about the sort of sacred river, at the bottom of which is this flat stone. And on the stone, you see the image of a dagger, the keris, that is there basically as a result of natural color variations. And of course, the people of Kajar say that that is, you know, it's basically a divine blessing, that sort of thing. But I remember walking to this river, and recently I thought, wow, it would be so wonderful to be able to go back to that river if ever I could find it again and try to find that flat stone. But the dissertation is wonderful because you really can picture it all.
I know you and your brother, the president, were very close to your mother. Did it stir up a lot of emotions? I mean, it's a dissertation about, you know, this kind of esoteric topic, but did it, in a sense, stir up some emotions reading it?
Well, I mean, I think we both are so sad that she's not with us. I have two daughters, and obviously the president also has two daughters. She really wanted grandchildren. She was never able to meet them. And certainly the dissertation brought up emotions. I wish she had known that others would have the ability to read her work and to consider her suggestions. But, of course, a lot of things have transpired in the last couple of years that have made me feel like it would have been nice to have her. More than nice. It would have been wonderful.
What do you think your mom would have made of your success and your brother's success? She was, by and large, a single parent. I mean, the odds, the deck was stacked against you and your brother. You went on to achieve a PhD in education. Your brother is the president of the United States. What would your mom have made of that?
You know, I don't know. She didn't necessarily anticipate, who could have, that her son would become president of the United States. But she knew that he was going to do remarkable things. And that comforts me, actually. I mean, when she died, I'm pretty sure that she was aware that he was going to be okay. And I think more than that, he showed her in ways large and small that he was interested in making the world better, that he was committed to the kind of service that she encouraged all of her life. And she also could see how charismatic he was and what a capable individual and leader he was.
You think it would have been strange for, I mean, somebody like your mom, who was so far removed from the corridors of power, who was so connected to people on the ground in a really direct way, to see that happen?
Yeah, that is interesting that you know, she spent time with people who were very, very poor. And she didn't reside in those corridors of power. But certainly the pageantry and the processes of being president would have held some anthropological interest for her.
Maya Sutoro-Ing is the daughter of Anne Dunham and the sister of President Barack Obama. She's just helped publish her late mother's doctoral dissertation. It's called Surviving Against the Odds. Maya Sutoro-Ing, thank you for sharing the story of your remarkable mom.
Thank you, Guy.
And you can read an excerpt from Anne Dunham's book about what happened when the village she studied got its first television set. It's on our website, npr.org.